Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
And I'm Lizzie.
And if this is your first time listening, we're a medical
sort of
podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way.
And we'll answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends.
On today's show, we have Dr. Kevin Poe, a board-certified internal medicine physician, author, national medicine commentator. He founded a massive website called KevinMD.com in 2004.
Stick around.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and or medical needs or concerns.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the House of Pod. Thanks for joining us. How are we doing, guys?
Doing great.
Pretty good. Pretty good. This is the new ritual, and we've talked about it a couple times, but every time this segment starts, Lizzie and I look at each other, and we're like, that's what I'm thinking. Maybe she's not even thinking.
No,
this.
I have no idea who you are.
I'm looking at you, and I'm like, am I going to talk first, or you, or if I be overly polite, and I'm a wuss,
you
or
can't
if I'm
talk.
Too, you see what I've done? I've turned you guys against each other.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to have to deal with saying something, so
right.
I want you guys to, like, battle it out.
That's true. I see him. He's, like, staring me down. It's making me a little uncomfortable. It's like back in the good old days of...
So, Lizzie, let me guess what you did this last week.
Okay, go.
You at some point went hiking.
That is true. How did you guess?
Well,
do I look sun-kissed?
No.
Yeah, how did you guess?
At all.
Aww.
Like never kissed.
Ooh,
like never been kissed.
That's hurtful. My dog is right here, too. She totally has kissed me.
I feel bad now. Yeah. I said it. It came out of me, and I thought it was funny, but now I feel bad.
I went car camping in Big Basin State Park. Which is beautiful. It's like redwoods everywhere. If people
car camping, I assume instead of a tent, you're using the car.
No, it just means
you're car camping.
Instead of backcountry camping, where you have literally the stuff on your back and your food, you can put stuff in your car. You're sleeping a few feet away from your car. You have the luxury and the warmth of your car, and we could talk about things like related to medicine.
I thought all camping had the car.
Hmm?
I thought all camping had the car.
No, that's your kind of camping.
I've never done the non-car camping.
Right. <Yeah. laughs> That would make sense.
Would make sense.
Sorry.
Just looking at
my
us.
My slender figure.
This is car camping usually involves beer. Backcountry camping, you can't really necessarily carry beer on your back and keep it cold and not fizzy. Backpacking, sure.
Not really camping, backpacking.
Exactly. So car camping is wonderful because if it starts to rain or there's, cold and perhaps hypothermia, you can get into your car.
You don't always have to bring it back to medicine. It doesn't always have to be.
We are. On iTunes, we are a medical podcast.
Sort of. Ooh, nice, Joe. As an aside, this is really cool. What I did the other day was I looked at like our reviews. By the way, if you haven't, rate us, review us. But I was looking at that area of the reviews, and then it shows you what people who listen to us also listen to. And it was like, Pod Save America, NPR, all this super smart
stuff.
Really? I was pretty impressed. I'm like, wow, we got smart like fans or listeners.
You're
or
probably
friends.
Just looking at your own list of podcasts that you've downloaded.
I thought that, but it was stuff I didn't have.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was really cool.
No, it is cool. I mean, we're very smart and witty or something.
Or at least our listeners are.
Or a few people are. Oh, my God. My dog is making a lot of noise. We should put her somewhere.
Down? Oh,
no.
My God. Sorry. I thought you were going to say down.
It's actually her birthday today.
Oh, no. I love your dog.
I made that date up, but it is. It's true. Anyway, so let's talk about some important things that are going on in the world.
There was something I want to discuss, and it is...
Wait a minute. What the hell?
It's a little bit heavy.
I thought... I didn't even...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Don't care about it.
No,
Joe's
I do.
Doing.
I do. Joe, tell us what happened. Tell us what's going on.
Well, I'll tell you.
Please.
Something big happened, actually.
Whoa. All right.
In addition to my upcoming rap career that I've been discussing
oh, dear.
At work, I have a story for you guys.
Okay.
Yeah, so I've been the manager at this company for about 8 months. I was promoted recently.
I know.
And I decided to step down as the leader.
Wow.
And whoa. I made a decision.
You demoted yourself?
I demoted myself.
Honestly, he did not tell me this. I had no
yes.
idea.
I did it because I felt in the end that my strongest assets towards the company would be in an individual role, contributor role versus a leadership role.
Wow.
So that was kind of some craziness that's been going on in my wacky life. Which
if only all our leaders would have that kind of insight.
Well, we're going to promote you here at the House of Pod.
Oh, God. What do you mean?
I don't know. I'm going to give you 2 cups of coffee next time.
So there is something I want to talk to you guys about. And it's a little bit heavy, so I was a little bit worried about doing it. But I feel like this is a safe space, so I feel like I probably can. But in today's environment, I think it's probably a good idea to do so. Talking about racism in medicine or prejudice, I think probably is a better way to put it for us in particular when it comes to prejudice against doctors. The reason I bring it up is I was reading the story about a doctor in Oregon. Her name is Dr. Esther Chu, and she works up in Oregon. She works in the emergency room, and her Twitter, she had this Twitter thread talking about how she occasionally has to deal with these white supremacists that come from way in the backwoods of Oregon, I guess, and they come in and sometimes they just don't want to see her. So occasionally this, you know, brilliant, I'm assuming, ER doctor has to deal with patients that just don't want to see her based on the fact that she's Asian, which is kind of an amazing concept. It's a very strange and almost fascinating thing to me that a patient would do that. And, you know, Lizzie, I don't know if you have any insight in this. I mean, I don't know if you've ever
I'm not Asian.
You're not Asian.
For our listeners.
What?
No.
But you might, at least on some level, because one, you're a woman.
True.
And two, you're Jewish. But I don't think you've ever worked in a place where you've run across people like this, right? You've never had to deal with that kind of thing in your training.
Right. I mean, it's very interesting because, you know, I don't know. You think of Portland as being very accepting and very culturally diverse and also a lot of a big Asian population. But clearly you're talking about people who are not as exposed to that. But we all know and we've made jokes before that doctors are very notoriously sort of the majority or the plurality is, you know, a lot of Asians, a lot of Indian people, a lot of Jewish people, you know, a lot of white people and underrepresented Black and Latino population. Yeah. So it is interesting that someone would judge an Asian person because if you were going to cast one on a TV show, you would see an Asian doctor, you know. But I personally have not had any sort of anti-Semitic statements or slurs. I trained in New York City and now I work in San Francisco. They're pretty accepting and diverse populations. Yeah. But certainly, and again, we talked about it on one of our first episodes of just being a woman and how a lot of my friends and myself, we wear the white coats, the long white coats, and wear a stethoscope, I think, more commonly than a man because we need that form of armor. We need a defense. We need to represent that we are a person of authority because it feels like people wouldn't assume that about us.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've not had racism or...
You know, I don't think I've had much of it directed towards me. I don't think people look at me and they don't assume I'm anything other than, I think, just a run-of-the-mill white guy. Although my name, I think, throws them a bit.
Yeah.
But I have seen things here and there against other doctors. You know, I did a lot of my training up in Sacramento. And Sacramento is an awesome place, one of the most underrated cities in California. And there's areas around it that can be a little bit less urban. And some of those areas, once you get like 20, 30 minutes outside of there, and then an hour outside of there, you start to see a slightly different group of people come in. And some of those people would come in with, like, you know, the Confederate flag tattooed on their body or a swastika tattooed on their body. And I remember a couple of cases where it actually was a strange juxtaposition of this patient was clearly like about white supremacy, had these clearly racist beliefs enough so that they would get ink placed on their body to show it. But then they were in the hospital and they're being cared for by either Asian or Black or Latino doctors.
Persian.
Or Persian. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And in my experience, actually, it kind of made me believe that even racist people didn't believe what they were saying because the second they got to the hospital, most of those people, in my what I saw was they were still so grateful that someone was taking care of them, that they saw these other doctors come in and take care of them. And they were like, great, someone's taking care of me. Like yeah. they were still like, they, it was clear that everything they believed about white people being better or whatever was kind of nonsense, because they were willing to let some other doctor take care of them.
Right.
They're so
You're
happy
saying
to have
if they really
there.
Believed it, they would say, get your dirty paws off me. Don't touch me.
Right. Right. And not that that's better. That's much
I'm like,
worse.
That's an awful scenario.
That's much worse. But I didn't actually see that. I never saw someone actually turn down care because of that.
You know, in the ER at Bellevue, I definitely saw mostly, and we can ask Graham Walker if he comes back, our ER guest from a couple episodes, because that is where I think the most, the peak level of intoxication, whether it's alcohol or whatever, you know, angel dust or whatever, some hallucinogen, that is at the peak kind of level. And I think people are the most disinhibited. And I've definitely heard a ton of racial slurs in the ER. Yeah. And a lot of the security guards down there who would come to at least show a physical presence, whether or not they touched the patient, a lot of them were, you know, at Bellevue, African American. So I definitely heard a lot of horrible things being said, you know, because in that environment. But to me personally, and what I saw once the drugs wore off, I didn't see too much of it.
I did. Every now and then something like this will happen. I think I probably told you about most of these stories, but every now and then someone will come in to see me for a procedure, and they'll kind of be like, so they're kind of like looking at me and they're trying to figure out, like, because of my name, where my ethnic background is. And there's been a couple times where someone will do something really strange. Like, I'm trying to think about the most recent time was someone's like, what kind of name is that? And I'm like, it's Persian. And this person went, I'm not making this up. This person went, oh, that's weird. You didn't look like you'd have a bomb strapped to your chest. And I was like,
oh my God.
And everyone in the room, all the nurses were like, whoa. Yeah, and everyone stopped. And I was like, okay, let's go ahead and go on with this procedure.
Were you like, I'm going to pretend that I wasn't incredibly offended?
It was so bizarre, and I think the person felt bad about it. I don't know if the person had some weird prejudice or anything, but they maybe just because they were so nervous, and this is like a strange way of like trying to make a joke and it
breaking
didn't come
the
out,
ice
right?
And just stupid. Yeah.
But it was so bad. Yeah. It was so bad.
But it's funny, you're saying the guy who walks in with a swastika, for instance, was so all of a sudden nice and grateful and sort of not what you expected. But as a care provider, you see that. And do you, you know, something I also read recently, I think on KevinMD.com, the website, was an article about, as a doctor, you making the choice and having that power and that judgment call to maybe not engage with a patient who you feel will be verbally or physically threatening to you.
Yeah.
And that's such a hard decision, because you see a swastika and you are making a judgment, and honestly, you can't not. Like, I'm not, you can't defend or, you know, say that that person shouldn't make a judgment, you know, because it's there. But maybe the kid got it 30 years ago or 20 years ago when they didn't know, you know, and don't have the money to get it removed. Like, there are circumstances, but you have to make a judgment, you know, when you see a patient.
You're totally right. And maybe those are the situations where you can actually reach someone in a weird way. Like, maybe they will appreciate the fact that the doctor taking care of them is not a white guy.
And
they understand that someone took care of them anyways, despite what they had on their body. And hopefully that opens their mind up a little bit. I like to say it does.
Right.
I mean, I'd like to.
I'd like to.
But my point is, like, these people would come in and they, you know, they clearly didn't seem to really they clearly didn't really seem to believe in these things that they espouse.
Yeah.
And when push came to shove, you know, and because at the end of the day, I think everyone knows it's nonsense.
Right.
You know, I think at the end of the day, you know, it's nonsense.
The concept of judging someone's ability by their
worth or their intelligence by the color of their skin or their sex organ. You know, I think it's obvious that that's silly.
Right.
I think when push comes to shove and they're in a life threatening situation.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because I'm reading this book called Hunger by Roxane Gay, which I heard all over NPR a few months ago and was promoted. And it's mostly about this morbidly, sort of super morbidly obese woman whose BMI is like 50 or 60. I don't know, because she like won't acknowledge that calculation.
That's big for our listeners.
It's really big.
BMI.
Sorry. Body mass index is BMI, and quote unquote normal is about 20 to 25. And it's a calculation that you can Google based on your height and your weight. And that's it. And that's how, you know, the problem is that BMI, or just obesity, being overweight, does predict health outcomes. And she really, a lot of it talks about how she feels essentially just fat shamed. She's like, people look at me and they encourage me to lose weight. But, you know, you don't think that I'm thinking about my body. I'm always thinking about my body. You know, you're not helping me. But it really does have medical consequences. But we do look at people and make judgments. So the color of your face is a ridiculous concept. But we do, you know, my friend Sherry talks about how obesity is the sort of the last hurdle that, you know, everyone's very politically correct and very politically sensitive about. Maybe transgender patients, gay patients, black patients, Latino patients, Jews, Persians, whatever. She's like, that last wall is obesity, that people can still make fat jokes and not be scolded for it and not be told you're out of line.
Can I ask, this is a question I don't have an answer to, but it's sort of an offshoot of that. You know, a lot of what we try to do these days is reinforce body positivity. People should feel good about their bodies. I do think that's reasonable. But is there a line between doing that and promoting someone's unhealthy lifestyle or right. obesity to a point that's unhealthy for them?
Right. There must be a line. I mean, who knows what that is? Do we know exactly? I don't know the data for a little bit being overweight, how that can project onto or prognosticate your health. You know, we do know obesity is related to heart attacks, strokes, heart failure, early death, high blood pressure, sleep apnea. Yeah. We know that, right? So, right. But I don't know that we know exactly what number is okay for you. And BMI is a little bit of an artificial representation. It doesn't show your muscle mass. You know, we don't right. have good measurements for that. So that's why it's, you know, not the most valid thing, but it's all we have, you
right.
know?
Right.
So I don't know.
And we're talking about from a medical perspective. Clearly, you don't need to tell someone if they're overweight, if they're overweight. Overweight people know that they're overweight. You don't need to tell them.
Right.
But from a medical perspective, we do walk a fine line between, like, you know, we want people to feel good about themselves.
I do have a colleague who told me a few years ago that a patient filed a report because they felt like he was scolding her when he recommended and encouraged her to, again, like Dennis Lowe said, maybe he shouldn't have said lose weight, but right. he did. He should have said eat healthy.
Right.
That's a big difference. But we all know that eating healthy and being active will probably lead to weight loss. I mean, right? It's just it's not a number we're chasing. It is a lifestyle, but they do go hand in hand, right?
Right. At the end of the day, I mean, there are some people who they have no option. They're doing everything they can and they're going to look that way. And there's no reason for them to feel bad about it.
Yeah.
And they're doing what they can to be healthy. And that's all that we care about is that people are trying to be healthy.
Right.
And we're trying to keep people as healthy as possible.
Yeah.
Anywho.
On that note, eat healthy, exercise. Don't be racist. Wear your seatbelt. And use a bike helmet. And we just put another few years onto your life.
Woo, job done. Good job, guys.
We can stop the podcast. Boom.
All right. So stick around. We have a great guest. We have Dr. Kevin Poe. He is the guy behind KevinMD.com. It's a hugely successful and awesome website. And it talks about medical issues from the perspective, usually, of healthcare providers and people in the healthcare world. So stick around. It's a great interview. Start with what drove you to create KevinMD? Was there any online medical voice that was there before you? Was there a complete lack of it? What was missing and what drove you to build KevinMD?
Well, I'd be lying if I thought that it would become what it was today. I started KevinMD back in 2004, and at that time there were only a handful of physician blogs. In fact, blogs were just coming to the forefront back then, and that was almost 13 years ago. So I started KevinMD because I thought it was a good platform where I can write an article, hit the enter button, the publish button, and then my article could be read by the world. And I think the light bulb moment came when there was a drug recall. I remember writing about that drug recall. And a few days later, I walked into the exam room. I'm an internal medicine physician. And the patient said, I read your blog post this morning, and that's when I realized that I could have a little bit more of an influence outside the exam room using a blog. And it's certainly evolved since then. So it's not only my voice, but I use that platform to share the stories and voices of thousands of healthcare professionals. And they could be doctors, nurses, medical students, and patients, where they can each share their story from their own part of the medical world.
It's amazing how, after Al Gore invented the internet, how things took off, right?
Absolutely. It's just incredible because, of course, we don't only have blogs now. There's just so many other social media platforms. You have video. You have, obviously, the podcast like the one we're doing. And there are just so many media that are out there that physicians and patients can take advantage of.
So another question, when you first told your parents and your family that you had an internet following, did they think you were a porn star?
Well, I think at first, my mom was probably the only one I thought who was interested in what I had to say online. So it certainly evolved, certainly past then. And at first, it was amazing that people would be interested in what I had to say. But now I know that there's a definite interest for a place where physicians and other healthcare professionals can share their stories and tell what goes on behind the scenes. And I get a lot of feedback from patients, too, because they're interested in what their medical professional is thinking of. And I think it's a great way for both sides, the patient and the doctor, to come together. Not only can patients learn what doctors are thinking, but I think physicians can learn what patients are thinking as well. So I think it bridges that chasm a little bit, and it brings everyone a little bit closer together.
Yeah, I have to say that's one great thing about your website. It's actually something that sort of inspires us in this show too, is to create something that works for both the medical professional and people interested in the world of medicine. I mean, my brother knows about you, and other than being a hypochondriac, he's not really in the medical profession at all. So,
but sometimes that's a full-time job, being a hypochondriac, isn't it?
So you do seem to bridge both those worlds really well.
So along that line, sorry to interrupt, but along that line, do you have a lot of advice or information for patients who use the internet as a resource for their own medical symptoms or complaints? Because we talked about that on one of our shows recently, and the guidance to give a patient who's up, a hypochondriac, if you will, at 3 a.m. doing a web search. What kind of advice do you have for those people who ask you about it?
Yeah, first off, as a physician, I do encourage patients to be empowered in their own healthcare. And if that means going online and researching their disease, treatment options, and diagnostic options, I certainly do encourage that. So you have proverbially a patient coming in with printouts from the internet, and I know a lot of my colleagues shy away from that, but it's something that is real, and that's something that I embrace. If you look at the statistics, I think that's like 70 to 80% of patients, they go online to research their health information. It's the third most popular use of the web after email and using a search engine, people going online to research their health condition. So in terms of advice I give them, obviously it goes without saying that a lot of the information online is questionable, especially when it comes to health. Even a site like Wikipedia, the studies show that 90% of health articles on Wikipedia have some type of factual inaccuracy. So I always tell patients, of course, they need to know the source of where that information is coming from. In terms of what to look for, I think sites from hospitals, medical institutions, .gov sites, .edu sites, I think they have a little bit more cachet and a little bit more, they're a little bit more reputable than, say, .com sites. And I also ask patients to know how that site is funded. Is it funded by a third party? Is it funded by a pharmaceutical company? Because sometimes that can bias the information as well. So that's my overlying piece of advice I give to patients whenever they go online. Know where that's coming from and know how that site is funded.
That's good information. Thank you.
Yeah, great insights, Kevin. What are some things as a patient that we should look for as far as red flags? You kind of gave us a lot of things to look for in the the more credible ones. But are there certain things that you know, we could look for as sort of vetting when we're going through these websites in general?
Yeah, just taking it one step further. So we talked about how it's funded. So specifically, does the site take advertisements? What kind of advertisements does the site take? You could look at the author of the article. Are they a legitimate physician? Are they a freelance writer? Are they affiliated with a reputable medical institution? And does that writer have any conflicts of interests? I think these are all things that patients can ask whenever they read health information online. They just need to look at it with a critical eye. And if they're not sure, that's what we're here for. That's what we as board certified, trained medical professionals are here for. We're here to interpret that information. Sometimes we can't expect patients to know what they're reading online is in fact reputable, which is why I encourage them to bring it in and ask us these questions, because this is something that we're trained at, and we can help patients interpret what they read online.
So Kevin, getting back to the website, how do you decide what stories need to be told?
Yeah, so I think that I have a pretty broad spectrum of sites, and I think the way I put it is that I like to publish the stories that people are involved in, but the public doesn't really hear about. So a lot of stories from physicians, what happens behind closed doors. I like stories that the mainstream media outlets don't often focus on. For instance, physician burnout, physician suicide, physician depression, I think mental health issues affecting both medical students and physicians. These are topics that are often hidden in mainstream media, and I think it's very prevalent and, in fact, increasing. So I do use my platform to shine a spotlight on some of these hidden issues. In terms of other topics, it goes without saying, we're living in tumultuous health reform times. So I think it's important for physicians to have a voice and share how they feel our healthcare system should be changing, because a lot of the decisions when it comes to our healthcare system, they're made by politicians and people who don't necessarily see patients. And I think that if physicians or if practicing physicians don't have a say in our healthcare system, it's going to be a detriment not only to physicians but to patients as well. And then I think stories from, of course, patients as well. And I mentioned this a little bit earlier, a lot of doctors, they don't necessarily understand or know exactly what patients are going through. So I have some patient stories where they share their experiences through our dysfunctional healthcare system and what they have to navigate and the obstacles that they have to jump through. And I think it's important for physicians to hear these stories as well, because when they order an MRI, when they order medications, when they refer a patient to a specialist, they don't necessarily have that done themselves. I've been practicing medicine for about 15 years now, and you know, I've never had an MRI. I never take a lot of the medications that I prescribe. So I think it's important for patients to share their stories so doctors can hear what they're going through as well.
I think you made a really excellent point about the policies and how doctors need to be a part of that. On one of our previous shows, we had Pratima Gupta, who is the vice chair of the Democratic Party here in San Francisco. And we were talking to her about how much policy is made regarding medical issues without real doctor input. And it's doctors have seemed to have been without a voice for so long. And it seems like such an important thing to do. How do doctors get more involved? How do doctors create more of a voice that can be heard when it comes to policy issues?
Sure. So I think that we need to first let them know that they're needed, that their voices are needed. And before social media, they didn't really have a way where they can get their voice heard. They may write an article in the newspaper, they would advocate with their local or state medical society, but there weren't very many options for physicians to be heard. And I think that's all changed now, because we have a lot of free, powerful platforms where doctors can write an article on a blog, where they can share a video on Facebook or YouTube, and it can actually get traction. I've had a lot of physicians on my site write about healthcare reform, and then you have publishers, you have newspaper editors, you have television producers notice some of these authors and give them opportunities to go onto mainstream media, to write an op-ed in the newspaper, to go on their local TV newscast. So in a way, it's using social media as a springboard to jump into mainstream media. And I think that we need to implore physicians not only to be heard, but also to use these platforms that we have in order to amplify their voices. And I think I've made a little bit of a difference by building the KevinMD platform. But I think we have a long way to go still, because physicians' voices still is their those voices still aren't in the forefront when it comes to driving healthcare policy. And I think that physicians do need to lead on that front.
Have you ever thought about using the platform that you've built that is a great resource for so many people out there to springboard into politics, for instance?
Do you want to announce anything on our show is what we're asking. You're running for something that we can endorse.
Is this an announcement party?
Balloons will drop. You won't see them, but balloons will be dropping if you say yes.
Right.
So
for our viewers.
Obviously, there are two sides to every health reform issue. And people ask me, do you post things that you don't agree with? And some things I do. I try to represent both the progressive and conservative side when it comes to healthcare reform, because I honestly think that we need ideas from across the political spectrum to really improve our healthcare system. So I do have both progressive and conservative perspectives on my site. Sometimes I would post things I don't personally agree with, but I think that those voices are important and do need to be heard in order to really have a complete view on a certain issue. So when it comes to, I think everything, as we know, is politicized, and social media, everyone's on their own bubble. So I really do make a concerted effort to represent all sides in the topics that I put up on KevinMD.
So I'll take that as a yes.
President 2020. So you had mentioned that you really want to bring a lot of focus and maybe highlight and attention things like physician burnout, physician depression, which we agree is so important. What do you find, though, gets the most views or hits, or however you're tallying your website? What's the most sort of common thing that people are really interested in, or feedback that you get?
Yeah, in terms of the breakdown of my site, I would have to say 70% are physicians or practicing healthcare professionals, and I would say 20 to 30% are non-clinicians. So the majority are physicians, and topics that affect their daily life tend to resonate. So, I mentioned things like burnout and depression. We have complaints about electronic medical record systems and health IT. I think the bureaucracy and amount of paperwork that physicians have to deal with, topics like those seem to resonate, of course. There are things with like the opioid crisis and pain management. And I think these are all common frustrations that strike across the physician spectrum, whether you're a primary care doctor or a specialist. All of these issues strike at their nerve, and they tend to get the most traction.
We've talked a lot about the medical health record, the electronic health record, being sort of a huge thorn in everyone's side, and I would eagerly read an article on that. And along those lines, outside of the taking the doctor away from the patient's bedside, and just we're all so trapped in the charts and ordering and documenting instead of communication and face-to-face interactions, how do you find, what do you think the pros and cons are of technology and the way that sort of medicine, in my view, and I want to know what your thoughts are, the pendulum has swung a little bit too far with respect to the computer, because I feel like I'm stuck at my desk for most of the time.
Yeah.
And what are your thoughts? I mean, because clearly it's helped, but I just want to know your view on that.
So there was a study, I think, in the Annals of Internal Medicine, where for every hour a doctor spends with a patient, they'll spend another 2 hours on an electronic medical record doing charts. And I think another study showed that only a quarter of our time at work is spent face-to-face with patients, and the other 75% is either on a computer, going through paperwork, filling out forms. And I think that's a ridiculous ratio, the way that technology has really impeded our interaction with the patient. And I think the big problem is that a lot of these health record systems, they're not necessarily made by practicing clinicians. Mm-hmm. They're made by engineers. They're made by people who don't necessarily understand our workflows. So it's no wonder that the transition to any electronic medical record isn't as seamless as it should be. So I'm not advocating that we go back to pen and paper. I'm certainly not advocating that. But I do think that there needs to be a renewed focus on the user interface and how it can bring doctors and patients closer together rather than driving them apart.
Right.
I think a common complaint from patients these days is that their physicians are spending too much time on a computer in the exam room rather than having a face-to-face conversation with them. I think I hear stories all the time about doctors that they have their back turned to patients. They're just typing on a computer while the patient's talking to the doctor's back. Right. And I think that type of dynamic is frankly crazy. So I think we have a lot of room to improve that dynamic.
We clearly need a class in medical school that is titled Typing While Staring at Patient.
Yes.
So in this age of Yelp and online reviews and being able to review your physician, in terms of what doctors have to deal with their online presence, how should doctors address their reviews? For example, if a doctor were to get a negative review online, should the doctor address it? Should the doctor respond as if you were like the manager at a restaurant where someone had bad service and they write like a note back? Or do they ignore it? What's the best strategy for a doctor to take?
Sure. So I have a couple of suggestions when it comes to patient reviews. So the first one simply is just to listen to it, because a lot of times when patients leave a review online, it's not necessarily because of their interaction with their personal physician. It could be something out of the physician's control. Like, the support staff was rude. There wasn't enough parking. The magazines were out of date. And and I think that these are all things that are easily fixable. And sometimes if you read enough reviews, they could bring it to that physician's attention. So simply just listening to it and reading what they have to say, I think, is helpful.
The coffee was too cold, right?
I'm sorry?
The coffee was too cold.
Exactly.
The muffins weren't moist.
not enough refreshments. So the second thing they should do is you want to take that conversation offline. So what do I mean by that? So I think a lot of times I see doctors, if they get a negative review, they take it personally and they start getting into an online argument with the patient. And that's really not productive in a couple of ways. Number one, it's very rare that online arguments result in anything constructive. They tend to go back and forth and nothing ever gets done. And secondly,
we've definitely learned that in the last 6 months
since January. Yes, right. Since inauguration.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And also it's a HIPAA violation because you're acknowledging a relationship with the patient. So you want to take that conversation offline, perhaps politely thanking that patient for writing a review and taking that conversation on the telephone and really discussing that patient's concern offline. So you want to take that conversation offline. The third major recommendation is simply ask more patients to rate you online. There are offices that ask all their patients to rate them online. And if you look at some studies looking at patient reviews, the majority are 4.5 to 5 stars. I think about 80% of patient reviews are in fact 5 stars. So if you ask more patients to rate doctors online, it will tend to drown out negative reviews and make them look like outliers. Mm-hmm. So I think that patient reviews are, they're an inevitability. They're everywhere, and I think they're only going to grow. So I think that these simple tips are some ways that physicians can think about when encountering them.
I'm sure the website and in your lecture series and promoting books and everything takes a lot of your time. So how do you maintain your clinical practice while sort of dealing with this other persona and traveling and everything that is involved in with Kevin MD?
Sure. So it certainly is a challenge, but I think that if I were to do clinical medicine 100%, I think I'd get burnt out, especially as a primary care physician. You know, you see 20 to 30 patients a day for 4 to 5 days a week, and I really don't think that's sustainable. So even though that's a lot of work, I think Kevin MD is a great parallel to what I do in clinical medicine, and it really energizes when I work on Kevin MD, when I do keynotes, when I work on blog posts or do some writing. I think it energizes that part of me, and when I go back and see patients, it gives me a renewed sense of purpose. I don't work full time, so I'm about 3/4 time. So I'm in the clinic only 3.5 days a week. So that gives me some balance. And I do a lot of my curating and writing and rehearsing before I see patients. So a few hours before and a few hours after my kids go to sleep. And, you know, it ends up an additional, you know, 3 to 5 hours per day doing Kevin MD. So I certainly I'm not going to lie and say that it's not a commitment. It is a huge commitment, and it is a big time commitment, but it's something that I get a lot out of. It's something that's tremendously rewarding, and I do feel renewed when I do Kevin MD when it comes to seeing patients. So it's a pretty full week, but it's tremendously rewarding.
It sounds wonderful. We talk about how to avoid burnout a lot, and doing this is the three of us, I guess, how we do it. But very important transition. Do you have any good foreign objects in body cavity stories? we're still working on a title for that segment of our show. Once we were going to call it a booty call, I think, you know, things getting stuck somewhere.
That's right. Booty call, I think, is a good name booty for call. The segment.
Yeah, I still like foreign...
You talk to a radiologist.
Right, that's true.
Wait, we're not going to stick with foreign objects in body cavity segment?
I think booty call is a good one.
Yeah.
Booty call it is.
Well, what's next for Kevin MD? Is there something new that you're working on? Are you just trying to grow the Kevin MD website? What's next for you?
So I'm pretty happy with the current trajectory. I think that I continue to build the platforms to give it more influence, to give physicians a louder voice when it comes to healthcare reform. And whenever I talk to other doctors, they often hear about social media from really a perspective of risk. A lot of doctors, they hear about social media from their lawyers or from their risk managers, and they hear about stories about their fellow physicians getting fired because they're posting inappropriate content online. So a lot of doctors, they don't really know why they should use social media. So one of the things that I try to do is present social media from a more positive perspective. I share how social media not only affects me, but also other physician success stories as well. So when I give talks and keynotes, I really try to present social media from a more positive aspect, and that's something I'm going to continue to do.
Great. Kevin, you know, since 2004, I think, is when you launched your site, Kevin MD, if I'm not mistaken. And
yes,
you know, over the years, you've got, you know, literally over a million fans following you. What do you think is the key to your success, or what do you think is something you do differently than others that have, you know, really caught on with so many people?
Yeah, it's really just grinding it out day by day, month by month, year to year. And like you said, I've been doing this since 2004, so that's about, you know, more than 13 years now. And there are very few physicians who are able to sustain it for 13 years while maintaining a, you know, 3/4 time practice and keeping up with the current trends and the evolution of social media. So I think that's really what sets me apart, the fact that I'm able to sustain it for that long and still have the passion to continue it and help it grow. So that's really what it comes down to just grinding it out for over a decade.
So what you're saying is that we shouldn't lose hope that we haven't gotten massively famous after doing this for like 3 months.
Building a platform and building an audience, it's a slow growth thing. You know, if there was a magic bullet where you could get like a million followers overnight, you know, it would already be done. But one thing that I've learned is that it's a slow burn, and it's an incremental process. So keep at it.
All right. So releasing Joe's sex tape won't help us. Let's closet that one for a while, Joe. Well, Kevin, we know you have to go. We really appreciate how much time you spent with us. And is there anything that you want to plug? KevinMD.com? Any of your books, for example, or anything else? Where can people find that?
Sure, you could find me, of course, at kevinmd.com, as you said. I also co-authored a book with Susan Gay, as you mentioned, Establishing, Managing, and Protecting Your Online Reputation. It's a social media guide for physicians to help manage and protect their online reputations. And you could find more information on that site, as well as what I do for presentations and keynotes. So kevinmd.com is the one-stop shopping for everything about me.
Thank you so much.
And Kevin, if you're ever in San Francisco, come stop by our little makeshift studio and hang out with us.
Fantastic. I went to San Francisco about 5 to 10 years ago. I loved it. So I'll be sure to do that.
Awesome. Thanks, Kevin.
All right. Take care, guys.
All right. And that's our show. Thank you guys so much for listening. Again, if you have any emails, hopquestions@gmail.com, or call and leave us a voicemail, 408-444-6623. And thank you to Nadeem Abubaker for producing. And see you guys soon.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.